Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we sit down with the outgoing CEO of one of the country's biggest healthcare systems and meet the Pulitzer Prize finalist whose latest book is all about dogs. But first, there will be a host of ballot measures for you to weigh when you head to the polls in November, adding to an already long ballot. And as the legislative session is wrapped up and we've gotten a clearer picture of just how many measures there might be, the lawsuits against them are also racking up. Here to tell us about a few of them is our own Cameron Sanchez with KJZZ's Politics Desk. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so start with an overview for us here. How many ballot measures might we potentially see as we head toward November?
A lot. But the short answer is we don't know yet. So the legislature has referred several. I believe it's 11. But there's also the citizen-led initiatives, and the signatures that are due for those are due on July 3rd. Okay. So that's when, you know, we'll start to figure out who qualified to get their effort onto the ballot. And then it could be quite a few, but I don't want to speculate too much. In response to that, you know, the counties are preparing to have very long ballots.
Very long ballots, many pages potentially. Mm-hmm. Why so many? Like, this has to do with the balance of power, right? With the GOP-led legislature kind of trying to go around a Democratic governor.
That is definitely true. So Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs is dealing with a Republican-controlled legislature who, before Hobbs, had a Republican governor. So with Hobbs, you know, she vetoed a lot of their efforts over the past two sessions. Mm-hmm. And to get around that, they can put up a measure that's passed on party lines and send it to the voters rather than to the governor, straight to voter approval. So it's a good way to get around that. Another reason is just that this is going to be a big election year with the presidential election. You know, there's expected to be pretty good turnout and there's just a lot going on. So it's going to be a big ballot.
Okay. So let's talk about a few of these measures. I want to start with two measures that are both about the same thing, about tipped workers, minimum wage. One was put on the ballot by Republican lawmakers, as you described. The other is a citizen-led initiative that has been collecting signatures. Tell us about these two competing kind of measures.
Right. So the tipped workers measure is the one from Republicans, and it says that an employer can pay their employees 25% less than the minimum wage if, with tips included, they'd be making about $2 more than the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is coming from a group who is trying to raise the minimum wage by a few dollars. And they're saying that this is a deceptive title, the Tipped Workers Protection Act, that it's misleading, that it's going to be a decoy measure to try to draw votes away from their minimum wage increase measure that they're trying to get on the ballot, and that it's intentionally done to trick voters and shortchange tipped workers, especially restaurant workers like waiters.
What does the restaurant industry think about this? Which one are they backing?
Well, the Republican measure is backed by the Restaurant Association and also the Beverage Association.
Okay. So the backers of one of these is suing the other. Is this going to potentially confuse voters if both of these end up on the ballot? They seem the same, but do different things.
Very different things. And yes, it could be potentially confusing. They're hoping the group that is suing is hoping that the judge is going to just throw the Republican measure off the ballot completely. But there's not really a precedent for that. So we'll see.
We'll see. Okay. Let's move on to another ballot measure that's drawing a lot of debate. This is the Judicial Accountability Act of 2024. What would this do, Cameron?
Well, this would, according to the opponents of it, allow lifelong terms for judges, basically no term limits anymore, because as it is now, judges can serve for 6 years and then they have to go to the ballot and voters can choose to retain them or to, you know, kick them off.
Right. We always see that long list of judges on the ballot that you can say yes or no to. Yes.
But this measure, which is also championed by legislative Republicans, called the Judicial Accountability Act, I believe, which is going to the ballot, and it would not put that question to the voters anymore. So judicial retention wouldn't be that kind of issue. It would be a merit-based system. So judges would be able to serve indefinitely on basically good behavior.
Mm-hmm. So there's also a lawsuit over this one now. What are they saying?
It's actually the same attorney. He's kind of making a similar argument. He's saying calling it the Judicial Accountability Act is going to confuse people because in reality, it's taking away voters' right to have judicial accountability. And that's a voter, you know, protected thing. And it's giving that power away. And voters would never support it if it was called something else. But it's supposed to be intentionally deceptive.
Yeah. OK. There's another big one here. Immigration, HCR 2060, which Republican lawmakers sent to the ballot after the governor vetoed something similar earlier in the session. This would give local police the authority to enforce immigration law. It's been likened to SB 1070. There's been a lot of coverage of this. This is also facing legal challenges. Tell us about those.
Well, so far, the legal challenge against that one is by groups who oppose every part of it. But they're saying that the reason it should be kept off the ballot is because it violates the single subject rule, which basically says that a measure can only address a single subject of the law. Mm-hmm. And this one kind of does a lot of different things. It involves fentanyl, for example, and money distribution. And it also, of course, is about border security and public safety. And they're saying, you know, it's too many things crammed into one measure. That's not legal. It shouldn't be allowed to go to the ballot like that.
So let me ask you before I let you go, how successful challenges like these have been in the past? Like, how likely is it, you think, that we'll see some of these measures actually make it to the ballot?
I think it's pretty likely that we'll see some of these measures make it to the ballot.
Is it harder to get them kicked off?
It's hard to get. The deception argument that they're making hasn't really been successful. You know, the attorney cited some cases in the past where, you know, a judge has considered that, but a judge has never said, OK, this title is deceptive, therefore it shouldn't be on the ballot. So that's a hurdle.
What about when it comes to the single subject rule?
I think that one has a good chance because judges have actually ruled recently that the legislature has violated the single subject rule.
Okay.
So there's a precedent for that one.
It's going to be a very long ballot, as we referenced. How does that change things? Does it change things for voters, for the way people run campaigns, for the messaging around the election?
Well, there's concern about what's called ballot fatigue, which is that if a voter gets to a ballot and there's that much stuff on it, they're just going to stop voting at some point. You know, they'll vote for a few offices and then they'll just turn in a ballot that's blank for the rest of it. The other concern is that it's expensive to have these longer ballots. You have to have an extra page. And for election day, it's going to mean maybe some longer lines.
Right, because we're already concerned about how long it takes to count votes, right? This makes that harder, I'm guessing.
That's what the county says, yes.
Yeah, all right. We'll leave it there for now. Lots to watch for on all of these stories. Cameron Sanchez with KJZZ's Politics Desk joining us. Cameron, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
President Joe Biden issued a new executive order last week that could help more than 500,000 undocumented immigrants stay in the country legally. The so-called Parole in Place order protects undocumented spouses and children of U.S. citizens, granting them permanent residency without having to leave the country first to serve parole. But while many immigrants welcomed the news, it came with mixed feelings for our next guest and her family. Arizona State Representative Lydia Hernandez says her husband of 28 years does not have permanent residency status and is still working his way through the legal immigration process. She told me while she was excited about the news, her husband was hesitant. Hernandez, a Democrat, is the co-chair of the Arizona Legislature's Latino Caucus and held a press conference when Biden's announcement came down last week. I sat down with her in her office to talk more about it, both beginning with how she and her husband met.
I must have been 26, I think, when I met him. It was right after I graduated from Baylor. I met him through friends because being from Texas, nobody here, it's different. It's a different culture, even within our Latino families. And I loved everything about me is Texan. So San Antonio, Tejano music, and that's my life and reminds me of home. And I was missing home. And they said, you know what? We've got a friend and I swear he dances just like you do. And sure enough, we went out and we weren't planning on it, but he happened to be there. And they introduced me and I said, no big deal. We ended up dancing all night. We danced, you know, we're from same regions,
Oh, so where is he from?
He is from Saltillo, Coahuila. So the state of Coahuila borders the state of Texas. But that same flair for music and culture is the same. So it might as well just have been Texas. But we laugh about it because we met here, but we were all from, you know, far away from our hometowns. So I feel like it was somebody that I grew up with, and we dated for about a year. And he said, you know, let's get married. So I said, okay. But he says, but we got to talk. We got to talk. I got to tell you, it's not going to be easy. He says, you know, I'm not like you. I don't have papers. And I said, what do you mean you don't have papers? Even me, at that age, having grown up in South Texas, a border town, understanding the issues. My mother was a legal permanent resident. We didn't talk about it much. It really didn't dawn on me. I said, it's not going to be a problem. You know, I had the world, you know, our lives ahead of us. There's nothing I can't do.
So this was like, it didn't occur to you at the time that he's undocumented and that that'll matter in our marriage. Yeah. What was the immigration landscape like at the time? Like, was it contentious? Was there a lot of racism? This is pre, you know, Arpaio, right?
Right. It was very much pre Arpaio. It was kind of calm. I didn't think it would be an obstacle and challenge. I thought it's going to be as simple as filling out the application. I can do any of that. If it involves me getting guidance, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. So we did. We talked. We got married. We got married June. I may be wrong here. 16th or 17th. But it was the same month and year that the Arizona State Legislature removed the driving privilege for undocumented. And it was all over the news. And we just got married. We just signed. And my husband's going, see? See what I mean? I said, not to worry. Well, we're going through the process. So at that point, we were inquiring. We went to several attorneys.
So you were hoping you could get him status?
Yes. We ended up applying in 2001 when we remember. So when he didn't have to step out of the country. But there was a backlog.
So you're talking about more than 20 years.
You got it. And so my husband's kind of lost hope. He wasn't as excited when I got the news because since then, he's been a victim of a crime. Our family's been a victim of a crime. So we also applied for a U visa thinking, hey, that might put us ahead. And even that, for the U visa, legal permanent residency, it began with 3 years, then 4, 5. Now they're backlogged.
So you've tried multiple avenues. This has been going on for decades now. Talk a little bit about how it's affected your life, his life. You have 3 kids in this country. Like, for him to have spent decades trying to become a citizen or even a permanent resident here and not be able to do it, I mean, like, how has that changed things for you?
Let me go back when I first got here and when we got married. I share my knowledge, and I like to help families. So in difficult and challenging situations where they've been told no, you know, there's always a solution. Let's just see what can be done. Same thing with mine. I began with that energy. Heck, I even got an executive staff position with Governor Hall. There were several more aspects of government that I wanted to learn, and all because at the back of my mind was my husband's situation. So as I learn more, I realize that you've got to be in a position of influence within government as an elected official. And you're in a different – you're on that stage. So that's what got me here eventually. Early on, when I was organizing, it's all about sharing your story. I had this lump. I couldn't share it even now, but give me a moment.
Understandable. Take a moment. I mean, it's emotional, right? Like this is, so it sounds like this has really not only affected your life, your family, your marriage, but like has driven a lot of what you've tried to do and have worked on for so long professionally.
Yes, it has. My whole life got enveloped in community, in organizing, running for office. I ran for school board. Always thought that I had to be fighting for those rights. And that's what drives me, angers me, and keeps me here. I think the situations that my husband been involved with, he suffers so much from anxiety, PTSD. You think, well, you know, it's just a way of life. No, it's very traumatizing. He couldn't live a normal life. He's always terrified that just the going to the supermarket or taking my kids to school. So when I, HCR 2060 was going through the house, you know, I've been through this before, SB 1070, name it, there's many more. I'm always, you know, talking about the unintended consequences, and that's what I mean. So they're law-abiding, hardworking, you know, he works construction, he works hard, and made many sacrifices to allow me to achieve my goals. So it's been a long journey. I've got so much.
It's okay. So let me ask you, tell me a little bit more about your reaction and your husband's reaction when this announcement came down.
I was at the supermarket. It was late, probably around 9 p.m., and I, chief of staff, called me and said, hey, the executive order announcement is taking place tomorrow. I was so excited because not just myself, and here I am in the middle of my supermarket back in my legislative district. I hung up, and I, before texting at the same time, calling my husband, I said, hey, the executive order is being announced tomorrow. This is exactly, you know, what we needed. It'll get one more one more possibility. And he says, Grog, he says, you know, tell me about it when you get home. And okay, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. He wasn't as excited. When I got back, I said, let me explain this to you. Maybe you didn't understand me. He says, yeah, well, okay. It's another opportunity, but he doesn't believe in it anymore.
So it's just been too many years, too many caveats here, too many applications that didn't go through, that kind of thing.
Right. He says, just tell me what we got to do. Just, you know, let's go through it again. We know, you know, we know what we got to do. But that was it. He says, let's see if this works.
So what would it mean to him, to you, to your kids, if this happened? Like if he did, you know, get this application approved, become a citizen?
Wow, I think so many changes, you know, our way of life, those unintended consequences. This is what I'm most fearful about, and that's most implicating when, like, HCR is 2060 this year, or SB 1070, he's not deportable. So I'm not worried about that. What I am worried about is what's very fearful for me is the implications by law enforcement or even other folks in and around that arena that think, that, oh, well, you're an illegal or you're illegally in the country or just based on the color of your skin. Because I'm going to tell you, I've lived this my entire life being married to even prior to that. But those are the unintended consequences of our hardworking, you know, families. That's not fair. That's not fair.
So the last thing I want to ask you is about, I guess, the other side of this, right? Like an executive order from the president a few months before an election, it obviously could go out the window if the election goes the other way. Are you concerned that going about it as an executive action as opposed to something through Congress, right? It just makes it that much more tenuous for people in an already tenuous situation.
Yes. And that's probably why my husband says, explain it to me. Does this mean it's a done deal? I mean, it's going to happen or is this going to go away? Is it like DACA? That's what he thought of when I mentioned executive order.
Is it like DACA?
And I said, it could be like DACA, I said. But, you know, I believe this is going to stick.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on and thank you for the opportunity of sharing our story.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the life of a show dog seems much more glamorous than the life of a household pet. But are they happy?
Breeders, when these dogs are still puppies, 6 or 8 weeks old, separate the litters into what they call show quality and pet quality. Mm-hmm. And pet quality in this world is a bit of an insult, actually.
We'll hear from an author who spent 3 years in the dog show circuit. But first, the chief executive officer of one of the country's biggest healthcare systems is retiring. Peter Fine will leave his role as CEO of the Arizona-based Banner Health at the end of the month. He'll then transition into a CEO emeritus role for several months. Banner's current president, Amy Perry, will become the company's new CEO. Fine has been in his role for 24 years. Before his retirement, he spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, and they started with how he would say the medical landscape has changed over time.
Oh, very dramatic. Lots of different programs and areas of specialty and growth. I mean, I just look at the amount of capital we've spent over that 24 years in building facilities and access points, covering everything from inpatient services to urgent care services to imaging sites to rehab hospitals to surgery centers, just covers a wide swath of areas of the provision of clinical services.
Have you found that the way that healthcare is delivered has changed a lot too? I mean, in terms of things like hospital groups, for example, buying up medical practices and that kind of thing.
Oh, no question. Over the years, the changes that have occurred in the provision of and providing healthcare services have been monumental.
One of the other big changes, and this is maybe a more recent one, is the increase in telehealth, especially since the COVID-19 pandemic. How has that impacted Banner, and maybe how has that changed the way that the company and its providers do what they do?
We've certainly, for the physicians employed by us, we have, in almost all situations, have put in new access capability to access your physician, either doing it through telehealth or doing it online through our portal. You can access physicians and schedule televisits if you don't want to get in. But remember, those are very limited. The kinds of things that people can actually get, in my mind, a satisfactory response to their needs through telehealth is quite limited at this point in time. It's fairly simple things. And in many cases, after a telehealth visit, somebody has to come in anyhow because the physician has to put hands on for an examination.
I'm curious also about the ongoing shortage of physicians, especially primary care physicians, but others as well, nurses, other providers, technicians, things like that. Is it in any way surprising to you that over the number of years this has been an issue, that it really has, the problem hasn't really gotten solved?
It doesn't surprise me because you're also dealing with population growth at the same time that you're trying to recruit clinicians to serve that population growth. And then you couple that with a growing intensity of problems that exist that require higher levels of service. And it's not surprising. But in many cases, some of it's limited by, you know, by the government. We today are capped, what I call a cap, on getting reimbursement from the government for graduate medical education slots, which are postgraduate residencies and fellowships. And very expensive for providers to try to provide those training slots without some assistance. And the government has provided that assistance through their governmental programs, but there are caps.
What kind of dent do you think that the relationship between Banner and the University of Arizona College of Medicine might be able to put into that?
University of Arizona has two colleges of medicine. They have two accredited colleges, one in Tucson and one in Phoenix. And in many cases, it helps us to grow the population of clinicians. But remember, growing medical students in medical school doesn't solve your physician problem. Because after medical school, they have to go into postgraduate training programs.
Right.
Of one kind or another. And so that's where the roadblock is. If we want to keep more physicians in this state, growing undergraduate medical education doesn't allow that to happen. Growing graduate medical education slots, which I previously told you had limitations in funding, that's where you have the ability to keep physicians within the market, because in many cases they will stay within the geography in which they have gone through their graduate medical education training programs. We fill our slots every year, 100%. And we get people from all over the country. And so we can bring people here who don't live here or didn't go through medical school training here and get them into our GME programs, but we have to be able to expand our GME programs.
I want to ask you lastly about, you know, we've been talking about some of the changes over your time at Banner. I'm curious more specifically the last, let's say, maybe 4 or 5 years, what changes that you had to make and maybe what effects that you felt during the pandemic have carried over and maybe have changed the way that you do your job or that Banner does its job?
Sure. You talked about from 20 to the midpoint of 22. For us, Banner handled about 45% of all the COVID patients in the state. That was an extraordinary burden on our organization. And in March of 2020, when all this came to fruition, our board gave management a mandate. And the mandate was save as many lives as you can and protect our people. And that's what we did, regardless of what it cost us to do that. And it caused a lot of changes in how you do business. You did see an increasing amount of video and telehealth opportunities growing and people running and struggling to try to grow those opportunities. You saw people like us put more resources into frontline access points, whether they are urgent care or physician offices. And so it caused you to think differently about it, and we began to recognize what that meant from a staffing level and how we were going to develop capabilities for the next pandemic when it comes down the pike and be prepared for responding and reacting to that. And how are we going to run our business differently?
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Peter Fine, the soon-to-be former CEO of Banner Health, leaving at the end of June. Peter, it's really nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
And take care. Bye.
The federal government is sending billions of dollars to farms, cities, and tribes to help cut back on demand for water from the Colorado River, which is shrinking due to climate change. It set aside $157 million to pay cities in Arizona that offered to leave water in the nation's largest reservoir. KUNC's Alex Hager visited some to see how they're spending that money.
Brett Fleck does not have an enviable job. He manages water in the middle of the desert for a city growing by thousands of people every year. Here in Peoria, Arizona, the majority of the water supply comes from a river that keeps getting drier.
We're really having a complete changeover in how people view the Colorado River from a reliability standpoint.
We're watching water flow into the city's pipes from a sun-baked canal lined with palm trees. In this Phoenix suburb, it's hard to get a sense of what the future will bring for water. But there is one thing that can help Fleck and his department protect against uncertainty: spending big money to find new sources of water.
When you don't have that reliability, you have to make additional investments for alternatives, backup supplies, etc. And that's what it really takes to make sense of the world that we live in now.
This big round of government spending for Arizona cities, it's billed as water conservation, but that might look a little different than you're imagining. The cities cashing in say you can only install so many low-flow showerheads and convince so many people to rip out their thirsty lawns. Cynthia Campbell is a water advisor for the city of Phoenix.
At some point in time, there does have to be a recognition of the scope of the problem as such. You just can't conserve your way out of it.
Phoenix, Peoria, and other cities in central Arizona are putting their multi-million dollar checks towards multi-billion dollar projects, new tech and new infrastructure that will help them in the long term. They're making existing dams higher so reservoirs can store more water. They're building purification plants that can turn sewage back into drinking water. Campbell's department in Phoenix is the biggest recipient in this round of federal funding.
We have to plan ahead and say, okay, it's not enough to have enough water to live this year, this month, 2 years, 5 years. We plan for 100. That really, I think, is the secret sauce that keeps us sustainable.
Campbell says there's a reason Arizona cities are so serious about reaching sustainability and projecting an image of sustainability. A year ago, state officials put a pause on some new subdivisions because they couldn't draw enough water from underground. Major newspapers framed it as the beginning of the end for development around Phoenix.
The moment there's a crack in the armor, the moment that we have to turn off a tap, every national media outlet will cover it, and it will have a devastating effect on our economy. So there's not a lot of gambling going on here.
But using funds from the Biden administration to buy that stability isn't something cities can plan on forever. Catherine Sorensen is former director of Phoenix Water. Now she researches water policy at Arizona State University.
Federal funding is always a dicey proposition, right? Relying on annual appropriations can be hinky, especially when you have to compete with other very worthy federal priorities.
But for the time being, this federal money is giving a leg up to cities like Peoria, where Brett Fleck says they're prepared to keep people and businesses thriving in the desert, even while water supplies are shrinking.
Do I think Arizona can continue to grow sustainably as long as we continue to make the investments and plan? Absolutely.
Fleck says the day they stop making those investments in sustainability is the day the state probably shouldn't be growing anymore. In Peoria, Arizona, I'm Alex Hager.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced by KUNC and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. And now it's time to dive deep into the world of dogs. Dog shows, to be more specific. And if that makes you think of the classic cult film Best in Show, you're not alone.
This is like the umpire calling a close play at home plate in the bottom of the ninth. I wouldn't want to be in his shoes.
And the judge is going over to the judge's table. He's signing the book.
So he's made his decision.
We have a winner.
A lot of hearts in dogs' throats. Do dogs react to this? I ask you this.
Oh, they sense the tension. They have to. They can't not. And here comes the cup with
Holy
Dr. Milbank
cow.
And Graham Chisholm.
Wow, look at the size of that. I've taken sponge baths in smaller bowls than that.
This really is the defining moment of this competition.
The Norwich Terrier.
But our next guest says dog shows are about more than fussy handlers and blow dryers. Tommy Tomlinson is an author, podcast host, and Pulitzer Prize finalist. And for his new book, Dogland, he spent 3 years traveling to dog show after dog show, following a certain fluffy white champion and his handler. I spoke with him more about it all, beginning with why he wanted to spend so much time learning about dogs.
Always a dog lover, never a dog show lover particularly. But one night I was watching one of the dog shows on TV and this question popped into my head. Are those dogs happy?
Hmm.
Because show dogs live a very different life. I knew that even with just a little bit of knowledge that I had, they had a very different life than your normal household pet. And as I researched it, I learned it was a radically different life. They're often pulled out of the litter at maybe 6 or 8 weeks old, train differently, they eat differently, they travel differently, they just live a very different life than a normal dog that you and I might have. And it also led me to think about whether regular dogs are happy, because they don't get to really choose their lives either. And so that whole notion about dogs' happiness and how they obviously make us happy, it was something I thought was worth pursuing.
Right. Okay, so we'll talk about the question of happiness in a moment here, but I want to first talk about dog shows because they're so interesting and they're such a kind of a weird world, right, of dog lovers, dog trainers, dog breeders, and you dove very deep into this and went to many, many, many shows, it sounds like,
right,
for reporting this book. And you followed a dog named Stryker and his trainer. Tell us about them.
Stryker is a Samoyed, although people in the dog show world call it Samoyed because that's closer to the original Russian. It's a Siberian hound that was, you know, years and years ago meant to like pull sleds and herd reindeer and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But now, like most dogs, is sort of a buddy and a therapy dog. This dog was a champion on many levels, won more than 100 dog shows all over the country, all over North America, and got paired up eventually with a woman named Laura King, who lives in Illinois and is one of the top dog handlers in the country and probably the world.
Hmm.
And so Dogland is at least partly the story of their journey through the Westminster Dog Show to try to become a champion at the biggest dog show in the country.
Okay. So let's talk about dog breeding and breeds in particular and how they end up in dog shows, right? Like you wrote this great line, you wrote, picking a top show dog is like drafting an NFL quarterback when they're still in elementary school. So talk about that. What does that mean in the breeding world?
Breeders, when these dogs are still puppies, 6 or 8 weeks old, take a look at them and they're, you know, experienced in what dogs might have the physical profile to become champion show dogs. And so they separate the litters into what they call show quality and pet quality.
Mm-hmm.
And pet quality in this world is a bit of an insult, actually.
Huh.
So the pet quality dogs are sold to regular families and they, you know, become normal pets. The show dogs, as I said, are trained and fed and all very differently because they have the physical characteristics. And by that, I mean, they conform to what people think in the dog show world is the ideal version of that dog.
Mm.
There are written breed standards that list how high these dogs should be, you know, how tall, what their eye color should be, what their fur should look like. It goes into minute detail. And the closer a dog gets to that template of perfection, the closer to being a champion it becomes.
Talk a little bit about that process. I mean, like, I think, you know, we've all probably seen a bit of a dog show here and there. And, you know, you get the idea that they run, they walk, they sit, they jump, right? There are things that they do, but it's not like agility challenges, really.
No, it is closer to a beauty pageant, I would say. But part of that is knowing how to show the best parts of yourself. Mm. There's a thing called a stack that every show dog has to do, which is basically stand still on its own so the judge can inspect it. And they look at things like, how easily does this dog go into its stack? How comfortable is it in that position? When the dog trots around the ring, what is its gait like? Is it faltering, or does it have a smooth and steady gait? All those little things that seem very simple and kind of mundane when you're watching a dog show, but are actually the result of many, many years of training. It's like, not quite the same, but it's like a gymnast learning how to do a particular flip or something. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time to make something look effortless.
I think a lot of people think of dog shows and think they're sort of frivolous, right? Like, I wonder if you came away from this with an appreciation of what they are.
Well, they're totally frivolous. I mean, what dog shows are meant to do, the purpose of them, is to identify the best dogs to be bred. So the closer a dog is to this breed standard, the closer it is to being a champion, the better it is, supposedly is, to continuing the bloodline of that breed's dogs. And so that is the purpose, in a sense, for what dog shows are about. But in modern times, and especially, you know, in the kind of dog shows we have these days, they are sort of a beauty pageant, and they are sort of intended to entertain more than anything else. And so there is an element of usefulness to it. There is an element of, you know, continuing the bloodline of these purebred dogs. Mm-hmm. But often it's just, you know, as they say it, they don't say best in whatever. It's best in show.
Yeah.
It's a show.
Okay. All right. And you go beyond this in the book, beyond dog shows. You talk about, right, like you talked about at the beginning, this question of whether or not dogs are happy, the more existential layer here. You talk about their bonds with humans and new research around that. What did you find?
First of all, dogs and humans have been together in some form for about 30,000 years.
Wow.
And humans basically invented dogs. So there were no dogs before early humans took gray wolves and mated them and basically domesticated them to become dogs. Every dog that's ever existed, from the tiniest Chihuahua to the biggest Mastiff, they're all descended from gray wolves. And they're all, in one form or another, a human invention. And so over those years, dogs have learned to adapt to our needs. You know, they first did very blue collar, you know, hard labor type of jobs, pulling sleds and chasing down big game and that sort of thing. And now, of course, most dogs are, the way I put it is, every dog's basically a therapy dog now. You know, they're all companions and best friends and sounding boards and roommates. And so the dog, uniquely among creatures, has learned to adapt to our needs and to make us happy. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that over the years, we have figured out ways to make them happy too. There's one study that I found along the way that said when dogs and people stare at each other, they both get a dose of oxytocin, which is sort of the like a pleasure enzyme. Along the way, by the way, they have changed us. Mm. I think in some ways, they've domesticated us as much as we domesticated them.
So did Stryker win?
Well, Lauren, you're going to have to read the book.
Ah!
I gotta leave you with something here. You can obviously go look it up.
More fun not to, yeah.
Or not. But I think the journey is important. And I want you to feel a little of the drama. Mm-hmm. In that. And it's more than that. You go actually beyond the ending of the dog show to his life after the dog show, which in some ways I think is also very interesting. It talks a little bit about how the dog show affects their lives, not just the dogs, but the trainers and the people around them after they're done.
Yeah. All right. Well, a little bit of suspense to end it on is nothing wrong there. All right. Tommy Tomlinson joining us to talk more about his new book, Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. Tommy, thank you so much for coming on and congratulations on the book.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Good Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. And now for the latest in our soapbox series. The theme is summer camp. Sometimes camp is just camp. Other times it sets your path in life and launches your entire career. Here's Phoenix writer Michelle Davidson.
When I was selected by my high school to attend Arizona Girl State the summer of my junior year, I didn't want to go. Sure, I was a straight-A student who served on the student council and was slated to be the editor of the school newspaper the next year. But I was also an angsty 17-year-old with an attitude problem and a habit of ditching class. Spending a week with 200 other girls in an old, poorly air-conditioned dorm learning about government sounded positively awful. And worst yet, it was in Tucson. But I knew the program run by the American Legion Auxiliary offered scholarships, and I was hell-bent on attending college, so I decided to go. I drove myself and the two other girls from my school down to Tucson in my boat-like Chevy Caprice Classic, arriving that hot June morning with no idea what to expect. Girl State is a week-long program that brings young women from each state together to create their own mock government and learn about democracy and public service. Arizona Girl State started in 1948 and boasts our current governor, attorney general, and state treasurer as alumni. There is no time to waste in the program. Right after we arrived, we were sorted into our mythical cities, counties, and political parties. There are lots of meetings and speeches. But before I knew it, I was singing the Girl State song and laughing with new friends. I had no idea that I would love every minute of working on our city's budget or writing legislation or helping a new friend run her campaign. Something happens at Girl State. Perhaps it is meeting so many smart, talented, focused young women from all over Arizona. Maybe it is hearing from elected officials and government professionals, many of them women, about how they have impacted their community in positive ways through public service. It could be the shared goal of creating a state, albeit a pretend one, that upholds the values and ideals of 200 young women. It could be the absence of boys. Whatever it is magical. Looking back, I believe that Girl State may have been one of the first times I was ever truly myself. As a teenager who watched the news and read the New York Times, I didn't always fit in with the crowd. But at Girl State, I was surrounded by my peers for the first time. While working on campaign posters and writing speeches, I found a part of myself, and I made lifelong friends. The legislation and party platforms may have been made up, but the intentions and determination behind them were not. Girl State ignited my own passion for politics. I have worked on dozens of campaigns for an attorney general, a governor, and a U.S. senator. I have also continued to volunteer for the Girl State program. Earlier this month, I made that same drive to Tucson again, 30 years later, to drop off my daughter for her own week at Girl State. Thankfully, she had a much better attitude about it going in than I did. And while she may not follow me into a career in politics, I know the magic of Girl State will stay with her forever.
Come to this land of sunshine, to this land where life is young, where the wide, wide world is waiting, the songs that will now be sung.
That was Michelle Davidson. Hear her story again and learn how you can write your own soapbox essay on our website, kjzz.org.
And the sons of men are blazing their priceless right of way. Sing the song that's in your hearts. Sing of the great Southwest. Thank God for Arizona in splendid sunshine dress.
All right. right. Thanks for listening on this Wednesday edition of the show. We'll be back with you again tomorrow morning with more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And if you heard a song that you liked on today's show, especially that last one, you can now follow us on Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app and you'll find all the music we played last month. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.